Okay, now it works. That transform under the action of each of the elements of G in a certain way, and moreover, they're holomorphic at all of the cusps. And inside of MKG, there's a subspace SKG of cusp forms of weight K, and these are the elements of MKG that vanish at all of the cusps.
F of alpha equals 0 for all cusps alpha in P1 of Q.
And one thing to watch out for, so the elements of MKG, each one of them has a Fourier expansion. That is, you can view it as being given by a formal power series, if you like, with coefficients in C, in the variable Q to the 1 over M, where here Q is, as usual, e to the 2 pi I z. It's not enough that the coefficient of, well, the constant coefficient of this power series is 0. That's not enough to imply that the thing is a cusp form. What you need is, when you consider the Q expansion at all of the cusps, the constant term in the Q expansion, or the Q to the 1 over n expansion, is 0. So this is the same as having Q expansion that starts, well, sum over n greater than 0, a n q to the 1 over n. But you have to have this at all cusps. And there, in the case of level 1, there's only one cusp, so it doesn't make any difference. But for level greater than 1, there's more than one cusp. And you'll very often have forms for which, if you look at the Q expansion at the cusp infinity, then the constant coefficient is 0. But at another cusp, the constant coefficient isn't 0. That's a gotcha that you should worry, that you have to worry about. Just looking at the Q expansion infinity is not enough to distinguish your cusp form in here. So anyways, you have this vector space. I defined it last time. You have this subspace. I just want to make a remark, which is that the condition of being holomorphic at every element of P1 of Q, it's really a condition just involving finitely many elements of P1 of Q. So,
more precisely, let C of G equal the set of cusps
of
G, a set of cusps of G, which just means we take the linear fractional transformation action of G on the set P1 of Q
and quotient out. And you get a finite set.
The fact that it's finite is an exercise. It's a finite set. For example, again, when G is equal to SL2Z, you just get one element. Everything is equivalent to, say, everything else. That's what this is. So here's a lemma, or actually, I think I call it a proposition in the notes. Proposition 137.
And it just asserts that, by the way, there are notes, so if anybody doesn't have a copy of the notes, I think there's a
printed ones. Are there any printed ones on
there? Right. Ah, there. Okay, so this proposition says that if
f is a weakly modular function, for G of weight K, and it's holomorphic at representative elements of C of G, then it's holomorphic at every element of P1 of Q. So you just need to check something for finitely many elements. So representative, by that I just mean you could write this as, say, C0 through CD for some D, where these are rational numbers, and really I mean equivalence classes of each of these. So, rational numbers, you mean the elements of the rationals you mean infinity.
So there's some finite list of cusps for which, if you check a modular function is holomorphic at representative elements, then you know it's holomorphic everywhere. At all the cusps.
weakly modular function f for g of weight k. That is holomorphic at representative elements of C of G is holomorphic at every alpha in P1 of Q. And
I could just state this and say, well, you know, it's just another thing to prove and skip it, but I'm going to prove it because it will be really good practice with understanding the definition of holomorphic at a cusp. So I will go ahead and prove this right now. And then once I've proved this, I will consider the definition, at least, of modular forms to be, at least in the classical complex analytic sense, to be done. So if you have any questions about this, let me know. Here's a copy of the book. All right, so now I'm going to prove the proposition. So we have C0 through CD. These are representatives for the set of cusps, representatives for the orbit of the action of G on P1 of Q. So G here acting through the matrices, and it's acting via linear fractional transformations, AZ plus B over CZ plus D. And our assumption is that our function f is holomorphic at each of these c sub I. So now take our arbitrary element alpha, and it's got to be equivalent to one of the cusps c sub I, by just because these are representative elements for all of the orbits. So alpha is equivalent to one of the CIs. That means that there's an element of G that takes one of these to the other, and I'll check in my notes to see which direction to write it. Alpha equals gamma of CI, or gamma in G. So there's some I and some gamma in G, so that alpha is of the form gamma CI. Okay. Now, oh, there's another trick here. Okay, so f is holomorphic by assumption at CI. Now, I'm just going to write down what that means, okay? That means that there's an element of SL2Z. So, just writing down what that means, there's a delta in SL2Z such that delta of infinity equals, I'm not quite done, this is just true, delta of infinity equals CI, and so first the existence of delta, that's just because there's only the orbit of SL2Z acting on P1 of Q just has one element, so you can always find a delta that sends infinity to your CI, or to whatever element. So there's such a delta, and moreover, if you consider f bar delta sub k, which is by definition, if delta is a, b, c, d, f bar delta k is cz plus d to the minus k f of az plus b over cz plus d. This thing, at infinity, has a Q expansion, and that Q expansion has no negative terms in it. So this is just to say that this is holomorphic at infinity. That's what it means to say that f is holomorphic at CI. It means that f bar delta is holomorphic at infinity. That's how I defined it. Okay, and now, here's the neat thing. Now I'm going to actually use something. So what I really want is that I want to find a matrix that sends infinity to alpha. But notice if I compose delta and gamma, I get such a thing. So if you take gamma composed with delta of infinity, you get, just putting these two together, you get alpha. So gamma composed with delta is a matrix in SL2Z that sends infinity to alpha. Okay? Now, for F to be holomorphic at alpha means that if we consider the Q expansion of F bar gamma composed with delta at infinity, it should have no negative terms in the Q extension. Okay? Now here's where we use that the bar K action, the thing I'm writing like this, is a right group action on functions on the upper half plane. This is equal to F bar gamma K bar delta K. Now that was because, again, this is an action, and that's something you have to check just by working it out and seeing. You can't see that just completely trivially. At least I don't see it completely trivially. Now, F bar gamma K, that's just equal to F, because F is a weakly modular function for G, and gamma is in G. So in fact, this is equal to F bar delta K. And F bar delta K, that's, if I can just erase this, add it in the right place, and that's equal to some Q expansion that has no negative terms, no negative powers of Q in the power series. Okay, so you see that knowing holomorphicity of a weakly modular function at each of representative cusps gives it to you at every single cusp. So that's it. So that's just a nice sort of practice with the definition of a modular form. Again, remember, last time I'll say it, probably in the class, a modular form of wave K for a group G is a holomorphic function on the upper half plane that has this property. If you hit it by the bar K action, the thing is fixed under that action, and it's holomorphic at all the cusps as well, which is the same as being holomorphic at a representative collection of cusps. Okay, any questions about the definition? And in practice, for computational purposes, usually the way that people think of modular forms is by giving their Q expansion at infinity, which is an explicit thing where to write down the thing, all you have to do is get these coefficients, which, if you don't know anything more about modular forms, you might think it's hopeless, because in general, this might just be some random list of complex numbers. How can you even describe them? Fortunately, though, each of these spaces, MK, G, and SKG, very important fact that they have, for whatever G you consider, they have bases whose Q expansion coefficients at infinity are algebraic integers. So that's a very nice thing. They aren't, in general, complex numbers. Of course, you can take complex linear combinations of the basis elements and get all kinds of crazy coefficients. If you take your group G to be gamma 0 of n or gamma 1 of n, then you can even choose a basis where the coefficients are all integers. So it's very nice. Okay, so that's it for the definition of modular forms. And now, if there are any questions, I have to choose office hours that are good for most people in this room. So the current, obviously I can't have office hours right now, so I'll block out from there and say Friday. Here. And I probably shouldn't have office hours during the T. 3:30. Okay, can somebody tell me some more constraints? Start with you. What are your constraints?
I'd like to have a Thursday for 200, please.
Thursday for 200. So this is something you want.
There's color chalk for
cool. Wait, what time do you want Thursday?
At 2 o'clock.
That's a good time for you or a bad time?
That's a good time.
Okay.
So I'll put
in green since there's money. Thursday at 2, right? I guess this is 2 o'clock. Okay. What about you? What are your constraints or desires?
Wednesday at 12,
Okay, this is gone.
I can't do from 11:30 to 12:30 Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Okay, 11:30 to 12:30. Okay, and we're Robert.
Yeah. Thank you, Robert.
I can do 1:30 to 2:30.
Okay. Stephanie?
Everything is good, it's not locked up.
What?
Everything is good, it's not locked up.
Okay, good. Stephen or Robert?
James.
James, dang it. One of those British sounding names. Okay. James.
Not too sure.
Not too sure? Okay. Robert, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tuesday afternoon, 1:30 to 3:30.
Tuesday, 1:30 to 3:30 is about here.
Yeah.
Okay. And Andrew?
Well, I was
going
to say Tuesday, 11:30 to 1:30.
Is that for you?
Yeah.
Yeah? I just wanted to try that. Lifters is 1:30 to 2. Which will still be available. On the green side is in the sub. What's your name?
Dustin.
Dustin? Yeah.
On Monday from 12 to 1.
Is that for you?
Yeah.
All right, so what's your name? Travis, yeah.
Oh, actually, Thursday from 1:30 to 2:30.
It's not good for you.
Oh, no.
Okay. Well. You're not going to come to my office, I understand. Okay, so,
Whoa.
The obvious remaining good time. What about, I mean, looks like this would be a good time for everybody. 12 to 1 on Thursdays. Okay, so I'll definitely have office hours then, and maybe I should have 11 to 1 on Thursdays, I have 2 office hours. Okay, so my office hours are officially going to be Thursday from 11 to 1 p.m. Okay? And you have to come, because I'm going to come in and be waiting, hoping to see you. So please come by and see me. All right, so that's that. Now I'll talk about, so I'm trying to give some applications of modular forms to convince you that even if you're not a diehard number theorist, you might still be interested in modular forms. And if you are a diehard number theorist, you definitely are interested in modular forms. This example is more along the lines of the latter. And I can't tell you so much yet because I've hardly told you anything about modular forms except the definition. So I'm just going to describe a little bit about this, and later on in the course I'll say a lot more once I have some more structure in place. But in the early 1970s, Jean-Pierre Serre made a conjecture, and if you read his interview when he received the Abel Prize, which is, I guess, sort of the mathematician analog of the Nobel Prize for real, and that it's from the Swedes and it's given to older people rather than only young people like the Fields Medal, he's asked, what's like the hardest thing you ever did? And he said, making this conjecture is by far the hardest thing I ever did. And he said something about not doing any serious mathematics for several years after finishing this. So it really took a toll. You can read the quote. I don't know, you probably knew him around. No. Anyways, that's what he said. And so I'm just going to give you a little bit of a flavor, as much as I can, at least, about what this conjecture says, given that I've hardly told you anything about modular forms or Galois representations. And keep in mind, I will return to this later. So I'm just going to tell you, just give you a hint as to what this is about. So here's a problem, or here's a group, G, which is the Galois group of Q bar over Q. And I once asked Robert Coleman, who's a number theorist at Berkeley, what he did when I was a first-year grad student. He said he was a number theorist. So I pushed him a little, and I said, what do you do as a number theorist? And he said, I study the Galois group of Q bar over Q. And that's how he defines number theory. And so here's a group studying this. It's, for some people at least, what number theory is. And
By the way, there's a subtlety with this group. It's an infinite group. It's the inverse limit over all over all Galois groups of finite Galois extensions of the rational numbers. So K over Q here is a finite Galois extension. You do have to be a little careful here, though. You might think that the right topology to put on this is the Kroll topology. This is a topological group. But the right topology, in other words, the topology, well, you could say that the finite index subgroups are the open subgroups, along with, well, you could just say the finite index subgroups are the open subgroups. That's the wrong topology, and using the axiom choice, you can construct all kinds of pathological bad things if you consider that topology on this group. So once I was looking at this book, Springer Lecture Notes 1585, with Hendrik Lundstra, who is my thesis advisor, he said the very first sentence of the book is wrong. And in the first sentence of the book, the author seemed to be misled and think that the topology on this group was just, you know, the one where the finite index subgroups are the open subgroups. That's the wrong topology to consider. The right one is the one where the open subgroups are the finite index ones that are the kernels of, so let me be precise, the open sets, the open subgroups equal the kernels of homomorphisms from this group, which I've defined for you, to the Galois group of a finite Galois extension. I want the things that fix a, well, sorry, they're the set of groups H such that H equals the set of all automorphisms that fix a number field. So set of sigma in G such that sigma of K, sigma is the identity on K. So these are the open subgroups, and the kernels are the normal open subgroups, but you can have others that aren't normal. So there's a distinction here because these are subgroups that fix a finite extension K. So here you vary over all finite extensions of Q, all K over Q finite. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you an exercise a little later in the course, probably Wednesday, which will help you to understand this better. So what did I just write? I just wrote down a collection of subgroups of G, where the subgroup is a set of elements of G that fix, that act as the identity on a specific finite extension of Q. Does that make sense? So for example, take a quadratic extension of Q, like Q adjoint I. Take every automorphism in Gal Q bar over Q that fixes square root of minus 1. That's an open subgroup of the Galois group. But if you take, for example, a product, take the compositum of, in other words, take Q and adjoin to it infinitely many square roots, like the square roots of all the prime numbers, then you get an extension, and you can construct using that extension a subgroup that is finite index in here, index 2 in here, but it's not of this form. So that's an example. And you have to use the axiom of choice to construct it. That's an example to show you have to be careful. Anyways, so this is a topological group. You can also, you don't have to think about this inverse limit. You can just view this as all automorphisms of the field Q bar, where Q bar is an algebraic closure of Q.
What is H under the subindex K?
This?
No, like in the that.
Oh, that's just some notation I made up on the fly. I mean, H is associated. I'll just call it H. So it's a set of groups H of this form as you vary over K.
Okay.
So maybe the clearest way would be right. H equals this such that, I feel like this is messy, so I'll just rewrite this line. H, which is equal to the set of all sigma in the Galois group, such that sigma fixes K pointwise. Sorry for the, I probably should have introduced a little more notation.
And then here, K is a number field. That is a finite extension of Q. So K over Q finite, not necessarily Galois.
All right, so here's a group. And a big question, if you want to understand a group, you understand its representations. The one-dimensional representations of this group are the homomorphisms from this group to C star. And they're called, well, they're completely classified and very well understood via the Kronecker-Weber theorem / class field theory for Q. So what are the representations of this group? I'll start with dimension 1. Dimension 1, these are the homomorphisms rho from G. I'll call it G sub Q, just emphasizing. You could do everything I just did, but with Q replaced by Q join I or something. But the homomorphisms from GQ to C star. And these are completely understood. Oops. So here's the thing. If you have a homomorphism from GQ to C star, with, and it's to be continuous, by the way. When I talk about representations, I mean continuous representations. And because they're continuous, well, if you take the kernel of such a thing, then you get some subgroup H of G. It's a normal subgroup. Because this is a continuous map, and here C star should have the discrete topology. So the inverse image of the identity element here is an open subgroup, and it's normal, so it's just the set of things that fix a quadratic, well, sorry, it's a set of things that fix an extension of Q. And so there's some field K over Q, and its Galois group, like Galois theory, is GQ modulo H, modulo this kernel, which is just isomorphic to the image of rho, which is a subgroup of C star. So anytime you have a one-dimensional representation of GQ, you take, just because of this condition about, this strong condition on what the topology is on the Galois group, you consider its kernel, then you let K say B, I mean, you could just think of K as being the fixed field for the kernel of rho. This K is equal to the set of all elements in Q bar, such that sigma of x equals x for all x in H, which is the kernel of rho. So this field, it has a Galois group by Galois theory, assuming that you know the basics of Galois theory. The Galois group of the fixed field for a normal subgroup is the quotient group. And that quotient group is, by the whatever its isomorphism theorem of group theory, a subgroup of C star, and hence an abelian group. So this K is an abelian extension of Q. And the abelian extensions of Q are completely classified by the Kronecker-Weber theorem. They're exactly the subfields of Q adjoint zeta n, where zeta n ranges through all roots of unity. So this K is contained in Q adjoint zeta n for some n. So there's much more I could say involving Dirichlet characters. I'll return to this theme later because there's a whole chapter of the book about Dirichlet characters. But suffice to say that one-dimensional representations, they correspond to the up to, well, given a one-dimensional representation, you get an abelian extension. There's a little bit of an automorphism that you have to worry about. But basically, up to some automorphisms, the one-dimensional representations correspond to the abelian extensions. Those are completely understood by the Kronecker-Weber thing. And this can be viewed as a special case of class field theory where the base field is Q. So another thing here, class field theory for Q.
And if you've ever wondered, or in the future ever wonder what class field theory is, it's the generalization of this question: understand all the representations of an absolute Galois group to fields other than Q. For example, take Q adjoint I. What are all the abelian extensions? The extensions of Q adjoint I with abelian Galois group of Q adjoint I, or any other field. That's what class field theory explains successfully. So that's one-dimensional representations. The next step is two-dimensional representations, and that's what Serre's conjecture is about. Any questions about one-dimensional representations? This is easily a whole course to explain one-dimensional representations. Maybe you did this last year, 7 years ago. Okay. Maybe I'll do it sometime next year. Okay, so, or the year after. Okay, so now what about dimension two? So this is the sort of thing you might see in like the second course in algebraic number theory at the graduate level. Pretty serious stuff. And it was worked out in the, I guess, the 1930s-ish, probably, by Artin and Chebotarov and the other very hard-working mathematicians. Okay, so dimension two. Well, that's representations rho of this group GQ, whose study is really what all number theory is about, to some people at least. So GL2 of, well, we have to choose what we're going to, what sort of thing we're going to use for our representations. Here, these are one-dimensional representations over C. Notice that C star is the automorphism group of a one-dimensional vector space over C. But I shouldn't write that. Following Serre, I guess, or just find what people often do in group theory, we'll consider representations to GL2 FP bar. And here this has the discrete topology. You can also consider representations to GL2C, and there's a conjecture of Artin about the sort of structure that they should have that Richard Taylor and Kevin Buzzard and Mead and have done some work on. But for now, let's talk about GL2 FP bar. And really, since I'm putting this discrete topology on here, the image will be finite, so I can just put GL2 FQ, where this means a finite field. Okay, so you choose a specific finite field, F2, F17, F389, F2000, and 2007 maybe. Yeah, I choose 2009 maybe. And then you ask, what are all the representations like this? So Serre asked that question, is there a nice structure for this? And there's a construction of, well, there were some constructions, some motivating constructions of Shimura and others that suggested that there's some connection between this problem and modular forms. Now, amazingly, and it's pretty deep in general, there's a way to take any modular form that is a, quote, eigenvector for the Heck operators. That's something that I will tell you about later in the class, what the Heck operators are. And that's why I can't tell you all the details of this now. But any of a very special, but not ridiculously special, type of modular form, this eigenvector for the Heck operator is named, well, if you take the space of cusp forms, actually modular forms even, for a group, there's a collection of a commuting family of operators that acts in this space, and you can simultaneously diagonalize their action on this space, and the eigenvectors for that action, those are the eigenforms, that's what they're called. So eigenforms are just special modular forms that I'll tell you more about in a minute. But the neat thing is that given an eigenform F and some extra data that just has to do with the, choosing a prime ideal, a non-zero prime ideal of the field generated by the Fourier coefficients of the eigenform, you can get from such a thing a representation like this. A representation rho of GQ.
And there's only one special thing that this representation satisfies. There's only one special property that it has, namely that it's odd. Not odd in the sense of being unusual, but odd in the sense that...
So it's a simple condition. Rho is, actually, since this is a general notion, I'll put it over here. Rho is odd if, well, representation rho from GQ to GLN of some field is odd if the determinant of rho of complex conjugation well, that's the one automorphism you can think of that lives in here. I'm going to try to think of an example element of Gal Q-bar over Q, a specific concrete element, where let's say you fix the Q-bar to be a subfield of C. Well, one that you can think of is complex conjugation. I've never been able to think of another one. I don't know if there's a way to think of another one that's completely concrete. But complex conjugation is one example. So you can take rho of it. You'll get a matrix, rho of complex conjugation. Complex conjugation, if you square it, it's the identity. So you get some matrix that squares to give the identity. Its determinant is thus plus or minus 1, and odd means that the determinant is minus 1. So there's a construction using modular forms that gives rise to representations of dimension 2. So I'll rewrite this. Odd two-dimensional representations of GQ. So given any so-called eigenform plus a little extra data, we can associate to it an odd two-dimensional representation of GQ. And so you get a whole bunch of them in this way. The actual construction that goes from here over to here is a theorem that you can do this due to Deligne and Serre. And Jumerat in some cases. So let's write Deligne, Serre, and Jumerat. And here's Serre's conjecture. This arrow gives you all of the odd two-dimensional representations. That simple. So that's sort of the easy part, though. I mean, not to prove, but to state. It's a reasonable guess. You have a construction that gives you representations. Maybe it gives all of them. You ask your friend Jean-François Mestre, for example, to you take some representation you construct that has nothing to do with a priori modular forms, and you ask him to try to find it. And he does every time you ask him. So I'll just put Mestre's name on the board. He's a French mathematician who's very good at computing things. And he, in fact, did a bunch of computations for Serre that helped Serre believe this. Now, what happens, I don't know exactly what was going through Serre's mind, but you might wonder, more precisely, if you have a representation, is there some data that you can associate to the representation that will tell you something about the group G, the weight K, etc., where you're supposed to find a modular form that gives rise to that representation? So remember that, you know, modular forms, they come in these little finite dimensional vector spaces, M, K, G. And if you ask poor Jean-François Mestre, you give him this representation, you say, find a modular form that gives rise to it via this construction, which I haven't explained to you very much. But he might say, well, at least give me a hint. Tell me what G is, tell me what K should be. And so then that sort of really, really took a lot of work. So Serre found a way of describing precisely exactly what the best possible trace of a G would be, and the best possible trace of a K would be, and then added that to his conjecture. So his conjecture is that this map is surjective, that you get all the representations via this construction, via a construction. And moreover, there's a recipe for the best G and the best K. So just write it down. I won't write down the recipe, but the conjecture of Serre is that every odd irreducible. Sorry, you don't need irreducible. It's easy to show it for reducible. It's every odd two-dimensional representation GQ of this form, so into a finite field, is modular. It comes from a modular form. And a recipe for the best G and K, for optimal weight. And the G is called the level, so weight and level. And I won't say much more about this except the a whole bunch has been proved towards this conjecture. So what people really did initially is they decided that for a long time people kind of thought that the statement without the optimal weight level part, just showing that the thing is modular at all, is totally out of reach and just completely, you know, you never live to see a proof of that. So what they did instead was they took a representation that they assumed did come from a modular form, and then they showed that it came from a modular form with the correct weight and level. The level part is a theorem of Ribet, refined by Fred Diamond, and refined in other directions by Taylor and Diamond. But what you do is you take something that you know comes from a modular form, you prove that it comes from a modular form with the stated level. And Bassi itself improved the weight part. You have something that comes from a modular form, you then, by what Ribet did, know it comes from a modular form with the right level, and you can show that it comes from a modular form with the right weight. So Edic 7 has a paper on the weight and source conjecture, which is about that. And by the way, this showing that a form that is modular with modular right level is that Ribet did was one of the most key steps in the Fermat's Last Theorem. Now, what Wiles did with Fermat's Last Theorem, he found sort of a hook that got people going towards proving modularity results. And my understanding is that right now, if you have something in a level is one, then this is a theorem. This whole thing is a theorem. And I think it's actually known with a bit more generality than that. So if you have a representation and the conjecture says that the level is, I think even just odd, then I think that's enough. But I'm not sure how much has been written down. And the experts who I talked to recently tell me that they believe that the method that is being used to address this problem by Chandra Sekhakari and Mark Kissin and all these other guys who did this sort of thing is likely to give a full conjecture in a reasonable amount of time. So this is an extremely hot active area of research for this. It's not, I haven't worked on this problem really at all except for the replacing this by C, but a lot of other people have. And once it's a theorem, it's incredibly useful for, say, algorithmic applications, because if you have a representation, well, you know it's modular, and with modular forms, you can do all kinds of things with the computer or algorithmically. So you get a lot of information about what can be done algorithmically doing this. So any questions about this? Again, I can describe things a lot more precisely once I tell you what eigenforms are, and I also have to do a little algebraic number theory and tell you about Frobenius elements of Galois groups and so on. That will come a little later. But this is a conjecture of Sarah.
And you could see that it takes a lot of faith
and imagination to, you know, really nail everything down that you need for this. But amazingly, over
about 35 years, this has really been central in number theory and
really gone a long ways.
Very impressive. Let's see. So. Wow, so that finishes chapter one, and I plan to start chapter two today, but I only have 4 minutes left. So I'll write down
an Eisenstein series. Actually,
I'm going to not do anything with chapter two. I'll tell you a 2-minute summary of what Manjo Bhargava and John Hinckley have been doing. So this is just another application of modular forms. And I'll just state two theorems, or almost theorems, and maybe say one or two words. So this is a theorem of John Conway and somebody else whose name I forget, and Manjo Bhargava. The proof is really due to Manjo. So it's the 15th theorem, very famous, I think. And it says that if you have an integer matrix quadratic form, So choose a matrix with integer entries, and then let's see, make sure I don't mess this up. Yeah, take a matrix with integer entries, and then it defines a quadratic form in the standard way that I hope you guys know about. And
you know, it has to be symmetric, right?
Yeah. XT. Yeah, take a symmetric matrix, and you get from it a with integer entries. So let's put a Z in the middle. You get a quadratic form out of it. So this gives you a quadratic form. And a very basic question is, does that quadratic form represent every single integer? Where represent means, if you run through all possibilities for the variables in the quadratic form, then will you get every integer out? Every positive integer out. So here's the theorem. If a quadratic form, by the way, here's an example of a quadratic form, x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus w squared, that's a quadratic form. And that comes from the identity matrix. If a quadratic form given by an integer matrix a matrix with integer entries represents all integers, let me talk about positive integers, up to 15, then it represents every integer. Represents all positive integers. So there's the theorem. Pretty amazing, isn't it? It's actually if and only if. If you have a quadratic form and it represents every integer, it certainly represents the integers up to 15. And the converse, amazingly, is true. And you can't replace that by 14. So if you knew this theorem, you can deduce that every integer is a sum of 4 squares by just verifying by hand that every integer up to 15 is a sum of 4 squares. Okay, well, on my watch, I have 3 seconds. So if you replace this by asking about an integer-valued quadratic form, don't require that the matrix is integer. You can have half integers off the diagonal. Then it's a little bit harder. It turns out there's a theorem just like this, but with 15 replaced by 290. But the proof is much, much, much harder and requires a massive amount of explicit calculation with modular forms. And in some sense, it hasn't officially completely been finished. So that's another application of modular forms. This part isn't an application of modular forms, but the 290 version is.
What is an example of that? Up to 14?
That's a good question. I don't know. We should look. We should find out. I'm sure Munjil must say. By the way, so Munjil asked John Conway for the proof because it was listed as a theorem of Conway. John apparently forgot the proof, and it was just completely lost. Nobody knew the proof was. So Munjil, he was doing his thesis at Princeton with Wiles and decided to work on this instead and found another proof that's very beautiful, very geometric. I saw him give a talk about it to high school students, and it was really, they understood that talk better than any other talk. So very, very nice argument.